Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Lanides, and alongside me is my co-host, Josh Molina. Josh, how you doing, man?
Always a pleasure, and I'm so happy we don't have to do the show at, like, you know, 4 a.m., 5 a.m., or whatever time we've been doing them. So, you know, it's always good to get together. I feel like we haven't talked in a while, even though
we have. Well, it's part of the reason is because we've been doing like a lot of the interview, quote unquote, interview episodes recently. And this last week we didn't, I spoke with Miguel Iturrate, the former matchmaker for Bodog Fight. And so, yeah, you weren't on for that one, but I got a feeling you're probably going to be on for the next one. So we'll see what happens. But it's always good to reconnect with you. As we're recording this, it is All Out weekend for AEW, the return of CM Punk, which Josh, you're a huge fan of CM Punk. So it's got a kind of a special buzz to the weekend. So nothing to do at all with what we're talking about tonight, but
CM Punk is a former MMA fighter.
There you go.
He's got one loss. And won no contest.
And won no contest, right.
So, and he started. And
he clearly would have won that fight if the other guy hadn't been high, you know? So clearly that was the difference right there.
Absolutely. And you know, if he had started when he was 17, not 37,
yeah,
like Herschel Walker.
Like Herschel Walker.
Who knows how great?
Good little segue there. So. Yeah. All right. Well, I want to welcome our listeners to the show. Inside the Hexagon is about walking through the major events, fighters, and milestones of Strikeforce, which was a very important and innovative MMA promotion that existed from 2006 until 2013. And both Josh and I worked for the promotion at various times. So kind of a subject near and dear to our hearts. On the episode that we are currently recording, we're going to be discussing Strikeforce Diaz versus Cyborg, which took place on January 29th, 2011. In my hometown of San Jose, California. The main event featured Nick Diaz defending his welterweight title against Evangelista Cyborg Santos. In the co-main event, Jacare Souza put his middleweight title on the line against ruthless Robbie Lawler. And we also saw the final MMA fight of the aforementioned Herschel Walker, as well as the returns to Strikeforce for both Hodger Gracie and Trevor Prangley. Inside the Hexagon is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. You can check out the other shows on the network at evergreenpodcast.com. We are in process of porting over all of our information over to the Evergreen Podcast Network. And in fact, we got a brand new website up. You can check it out at insidethehexagon.com. But the fallout from our previous event episode, Strikeforce Henderson versus Babalu 2, we were coming off possibly the most exciting Strikeforce event in the promotion's history up to that point, as Henderson versus Babalu 2 featured four main card knockouts, and all of them were pretty brutal. In particular, Robbie Lawler turning out Matt Lindland's lights was an all-time highlight, as was Paul Daly's face-planting left hand on the face of Scott Smith, much to the chagrin of Josh, as Mr. Smith was one of his favorite fighters. We also saw Dan Henderson knock out Babalu Sobral. Hendo and Lawler both earned title shots in their respective weight classes as a result, so a really, really fun card to watch. It didn't have any classic battles on it. All four fights ended fairly quickly, but it was definitely a very memorable card and again, worth the watch. So let's talk about some of the fight announcements and what was kind of going on leading up to Diaz versus Cyborg. Originally, Nick Diaz was supposed to face Jason Mayhem Miller in a grudge match in the main event of this card. However, according to MMA Weekly, they couldn't come to an agreement on what weight to contest the fight at. Nick Diaz normally fought at 170 at this point, while Mayhem was at 185 pounds. Although they both went back and forth, I believe. I'm pretty sure that they both had fights at the other. I know for a fact that Diaz had fights at 185, and I believe Mayhem had fights at 170. But as a reminder, these two had begun feuding when Mayhem interrupted Jake Shields' post-fight interview at the Nashville event in April of 2010, setting off a melee that included the Diaz brothers and Gilbert Melendez jumping on Mayhem, and the feud just continued to build from there. And Strikeforce promoter Scott Coker was interviewed around this time, stating that he really hoped to be able to put together a Nick Diaz versus Mayhem Miller fight in the future. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, but seemingly unfortunately, it would never happen. So instead, Diaz would put on the title on the line against Cyborg Santos, the then husband of Chris Cyborg, who was the Strikeforce women's featherweight champion at that time. So this would look to be a crowd-pleasing fight, but not exactly on the level of Diaz versus Mayhem. But I will tell you, and without a spoiler, that it was a very, very entertaining main event. All right, a few weeks before Diaz versus Cyborg, Strikeforce ran a Challengers event at the Nashville Municipal Auditorium, just about 25 minutes from where I currently sit. Took place on January 7, 2011. There were some very notable names on this card, and it drew 2,631 fans to the venue. In action were Dustin Ortiz, recent Bellator title challenger, and I say recent meaning today, Bellator title challenger John Salter, and then Ovince St. Pro was back. And for OSP, this was his third Strikeforce event in a row. He fought on three straight Strikeforce events, all of these fights taking place in less than 7 weeks. So he set two Strikeforce records there in that he was the only Strikeforce fighter to fight on three straight Strikeforce events, and he was the only one to complete three Strikeforce events in under 7 weeks. So pretty amazing there. And he won all three fights. And this win here gave OSP 8 wins in a row, which set him up for a big-time fight with Gegard Mousasi. Another notable name made her Strikeforce debut on this card as the GOAT, the women's GOAT, Amanda Nunes, knocked out Julia Budd in just 14 seconds. She was now on a 6-fight win streak. She was expected to fight on a big Strikeforce event soon after this, but sustained a foot injury. But she would be back later in the year.
It's crazy to think that Amanda Nunes was in Strikeforce, and it's just a reminder that Strikeforce, Scott Coker, just visionaries in promoting women's MMA at a time when, as you've talked about, they were a distant second in the fight against the UFC, and the UFC was just flat out discriminatory. Well, maybe not discriminatory, but just flat out saying, we're not going to do women's MMA, and Strikeforce made money off it. They introduced the sport to obviously Ronda Rousey and Miesha Tate and these others, and well, now women's MMA is still big. So just that's one of Strikeforce's big legacies, and we see it here.
It might actually be their biggest legacy. I mean, you look at some of the fighters that made their bones in Strikeforce from the male side, you know, Daniel Cormier, Tyron Woodley, Luke Rockhold. I mean, there's a, you know, obviously a bunch of guys, Jacare Souza, and Nick Diaz had a name before he came here, but really established himself as one of the elite, you know, welterweights in the world with Strikeforce. And, you know, it's you can't deny that, but they're so important to women's MMA, to your point, Josh. I mean, just so important to women's MMA. Dana White had made a point of saying he was not going to do women's MMA, would never do it. And he saw these female fighters and how talented they were. And obviously, I'm sure from the bottom line perspective, that affected the reversal of his feelings and his standing on the subject. And, you know, so, I mean, can we say that we wouldn't have Amanda Nunes, and we wouldn't have, you know, these women, these female fighters that we have today and you know, as established as it is today without Strikeforce? We don't know for sure because, you know, maybe Dana would have reversed course anyways. Maybe Bellator would have picked it up and, you know, run with it, and Dana would have, you know, then taken. I mean, we don't know, but there's just no doubt that women's MMA owes a debt of gratitude to Scott Coker and Strikeforce for giving them the mainstream MMA, at least mainstream platform that they got, you know?
So. Yeah, I mean, nobody could have seen how huge Ronda Rousey would become just because she was pinning or submitting girls in seconds. So Strikeforce got a bit of a break there, but still, they valued that, hey, women can compete on a level that men can in terms of, you know, being a draw. And they took a chance. They took a risk. It's just too bad, Phil, that Strikeforce never promoted tag team MMA because that I would love to see in the UFC. And if you ever watched that, like, there's a couple of, like, YouTube indie things where they tried to do that. And obviously it's, you know, there's so many problems that can happen with something like that. But can you imagine? I mean, one time.
I kind of love the idea of a guy being like in a rear naked choke and he's reaching out to make the tag.
Yeah.
And, you know, the guy on the outside's got to hold the tag rope and he's reaching out as far as he can and their fingers are just too far away. And then the guy that's got the choke on just, you know, wraps the body triangle and rolls away. and then guy's forced to. I mean, that's good drama right there. So. That would actually be pretty cool.
I mean, I see how it's hokey and it's too pro wrestling, but
yeah.
I'd also like to see it tried once, just once, and see what would happen. You know, I mean, you never know till you see it on a big stage. You know, but you know, what if you had a Amanda Nunes and John Jones, right, taking on, you know, Daniel Cormier and Ronda Rousey, you know, mixed tag. Like,
oh, and now we're going intergender mixed tag MMA. Jeez.
It's 2021. You know, we
I don't
keep pushing the envelope.
I don't think we're going to see that.
Okay. All right.
Well, speaking of Daniel Cormier, he was also competing on this card. He wanted a decision against Devin Cole, which brought his record to 7-0 and set him up for a big card event soon. And then in the main event, the aforementioned Tyron Woodley ran his record to 8-0 after a decision win over fellow future Strikeforce welterweight champion Tarek Saffiedean. I wouldn't have minded being at that card. I mean, that sounds like a really, really good card. So, you know, obviously those names were not as big back then as they are now. But, I mean, you know, a card with Tarek Saffiedean and Tyron Woodley and Daniel Cormier and Amanda Nunez. And, I mean, that's, you know, Vince St. Pro. I mean, that's a really solid lineup. So, that if you put that card together today, you know, that'd be a legit UFC card for sure. So pretty amazing. All right, well, this brings us to Strikeforce Diaz versus Cyborg. It again took place on Saturday, January 29th, 2011 at the HP Pavilion in San Jose, California. Commentating once again would be Mauro Ranallo, Frank Shamrock, and Pat Miletich. Again, don't know what was going on with Gus Johnson. According to Wikipedia, which as we all know is always right, they did cite an article where it said that Miletich was standing in for Gus Johnson on this one. But we'd seen Miletich on several cards in a row as far as the main ones go. So not sure what was going on there. But again, Jimmy Lennon Jr. would be handling the ring announcing. The event drew 9,059 fans, of which 8,817 were paid. And the Showtime broadcast drew 561,000 viewers on average with a peak of 850,000 viewers.
That's like an episode of AEW Dynamite.
Since Punk came, because now their Dynamite ratings are up over a million. But yes, this is more like a Rampage rating. But yeah.
Yeah, I would say though, I'm so glad that Pat Miletich was there. He's so much better than Gus Johnson. And
yeah.
He said he just so many times, we can't point everyone out, but so many times watching the fights tonight, you know, or this show, he would say something and then it would happen. And that's just so cool to see.
He's so cerebral as an analyst. And I really thought that him and Frank would be a bad match because they're both former world champion fighters. So it's like, why do we need both of them as, you know, essentially providing that color commentary? But they just really played really well off each other. And then you could, you know, Frank talked about it in one of our interviews that him and Pat were supposed to fight at one point and it actually got a little bit awkward between them and, you know, that sort of thing. And there was a comment at the end of the fight here tonight where I don't want to spoil it, but basically there were some family members for one of the losing fighters there in the audience that was very emotional. And Frank talked about having his pregnant wife at ringside for one of his fights, and Pat says, well, that just tells you what kind of guy you are, Frank. And Frank just like burst out laughing. And you know, like just like a little tiny little dig like that, you know. And it's like that I dug it, you know, like. And Frank, you know, took it in stride and basically gave Pat that spotlight moment, you know, of like, all right, you got me, you know. And so I there's just kind of this underlying simmering, you know, they were very different fighters. And so it was also, you know, it was cool to kind of hear those differing perspectives. And I feel like they just gelled and it worked really well. You know, as you know, Josh, well, both of us, neither of us were big fighters of Gus Johnson. And that was a pretty, I don't think anybody in MMA was a big fan of Gus Johnson's. But I, you know, so even more so, I really liked having Pat out there too. And I think it worked. I think that threesome in the booth worked really, really well.
Yeah. And I just want to say, you know, you tell the story about, you know, Frank and his wife. That's why, Phil, I swear, if I ever go on a game show, if I ever have to do anything in front of a lot of people where I can be embarrassed, I'm not telling my kids, I'm not telling my wife, I'm not telling anybody, because I don't want them to be embarrassed. Like, I never understand like why these fighters bring their kids, you know, to watch them get their like beat. Like, it's traumatic. Like, what like 6-year old wants to see their mom or dad just pummeled, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, obviously in the, what you mentioned, that person can handle it because they're also a fighter, but I think leave them at home and let them break the news when you get home.
And you know, do you remember what the worst example of what we're talking about is? Do you remember, like, do you know what I'm hinting at?
Probably, but I don't know exactly, but I'll probably
remember. Do you remember Mick Foley against The Rock in what was it, Wrestling with Shadows, I think it was?
Beyond the Mat.
There you go. Yeah. Wrestling with Shadows was Bret Hart's book. Yeah, Beyond the Mat. And for listeners that don't remember, that's an excellent wrestling documentary movie. If you've never watched, I think when it came out in 98, I know it's been on Netflix. I don't know if it still is, but excellent behind the scenes look at the WWF in the late 90s. But Mick Foley and The Rock were in a very, very memorable feud. And it was, I want to say it was in Anaheim, and they did an I Quit match at the Royal Rumble. And they were supposed to, Mankind knew that he was going to take some chair shots to the head. And this is, of course, pre-CTE and all that stuff. And The Rock, they apparently had agreed on like a certain number, and it was a much lower number than it ended up being. I want to say he ended up taking 13, not just chair shots to the head, but his hands were handcuffed behind his back. And he got cut open, and it was bleeding like a stuck pig. You know, obviously had to be concussed. And Foley's young kids, two young children at that time, were in the audience with their mom, and like the cameras from Beyond the Mat caught him, and eventually his wife took the kids to the back and they were crying. And I mean, it was just bad. And they show them, especially his daughter Noelle coming in and him getting stitched up. And she's like, "Dad," you know, he's like, daddy's okay. And then there was this big thing because The Rock didn't come back and check on him afterwards. So they actually had some heat for a while there, but that's, you know, the most well-known worst example of that. In MMA, probably the closest I can think of with that is Mark Coleman lost twice to Fedor, and the second time they were in Vegas, and Coleman had his daughters, I don't know if they were actually cage side or what, but he brought his daughters into the ring, and they're both like bawling their eyes out because daddy looked bad, like Fedor put a whooping on him, and he picks up his girls, and Fedor's over there, you know, for Fedor, smiling, and uh-huh. You know, and the daughters are, you know, they're scared of him. And Coleman's, you know, no, it's okay. He's okay. And daddy's okay. And he's a nice man. And, you know, all this stuff. And I'm like, they're probably traumatized and scared of Russians for the rest of their lives. So,
as they should be.
Yeah, exactly. Go America. But I hear you, man. Like, I'm kind of like, I'm in your camp. I don't know that I would want the pressure on my side of having my family there. I remember Joe Riggs, we interviewed him on here, and he talked about beating Eugene Jackson up in front of his boys at ringside, and that it actually messed with him a little bit, that he was like, I don't want to do this in front of his sons. And so from both an opponent's perspective, of course, actually, then maybe it works for me. Then if I'm the underdog and I bring my kids, maybe the other guy will feel bad for me and not try as hard. But yeah, I agree with you, man. Just kind of, I mean, as much as a fan of the Rocky movies as I am, I just don't think it's a good idea to have, you know, have spouses and kids at ringside when you're, especially in a legit, you know, fight situation.
So. Yeah, and I got to say, by the way, Dwayne Johnson does not get enough blame for doing that. I know he's untouchable, super popular, but my goodness, like, he totally broke the rules there.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah. You guys agree on especially knowing that your guy is going to be handcuffed, and you agree on a certain amount of chair shots, you don't go over that amount of chair shots. And in fact, you're making sure the guy's okay, you know, before. But I mean, he was just, I don't know what happened. He should have gotten way more, you know, heat on him and gotten way more in trouble. But obviously, I mean, he wasn't super, super, superstar status that he would get to yet.
Yeah.
But, you know, still that was, it was egregious.
That's why I'm Team Cena for life.
Well, you can't see me. All right, one last little quick note, and then we'll get into the card. But this would be the last Strikeforce event to feature amateurs on the undercard. I would say the last Strikeforce card, correct. Yeah, to feature amateurs on the undercard, only pros going forward. But let's jump into the undercard. There are a bunch of fights on here. 150 pounds, Anthony Dariano defeated Alan Perez via unanimous decision. At 165 pounds, Ricky Jackson defeated his brother from another mother, Nico Jackson, via unanimous decision. I'm assuming that they weren't related. 170 pounds, Armin Safiari defeated Sam Bracamonte via unanimous decision. 180 pounds, Ron Kessler defeated Eric Lawson by submission, come by way of triangle armbar at 157 of the first round. At 155 pounds, Isaiah Hill defeated Bobby Stack via submission, coming by way of triangle choke at 102 of the first round. At 125 pounds, women's fight, Jenna Castillo defeated Charlene Gellner via KO, coming by way of knees at 357 of the second round. And then 170 pounds, Nate Moore defeated Nathan Coy via TKO, come by way of strikes at 25 seconds of the second round. At 135 pounds, Jermaine de Randami. I always have trouble with her last name. She's a current UFC fighter. She defeated Stephanie Weber by KO, come by way of knees at 425 of the first round. And then finally, 170 pounds, James Terry defeated Lucas Gamaza via TKO, come by way of strikes at 326 of the first round.
You know, it was super long undercard. You wonder why they couldn't have put one of these on the main show. I was doing a little bit of research, and the Wrestling Observer notes that it was a purposely short show. Showtime only wanted four fights live because they had two title matches that had the possibility of going five rounds. And their philosophy, which obviously differs from the UFC, is to not air prelim fights. Because of that, Strikeforce's philosophy is generally not to put any name fighters in prelims, concentrating on local talent that may help sell tickets. So, interesting sort of insight there on why we had this massive undercard and a very short main show.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at their challengers cards, you would see named guys. You would see Daniel Cormier, Tyron Woodley, Luke Rockhold. You would see guys that were names on the rise at the very least. So why not put them on the undercard of the main bouts? But yeah, the philosophy was, let's use them on the challengers cards to help, you know, sell those tickets. And then, you know, as far as the undercard of the main tentpole events, so to speak, you use local guys that are actually not only just going to help sell tickets from a drawing perspective, but they literally sell tickets. Like they will put tickets in the local fight gyms and sell them there. And then they get to keep a chunk of it. And then obviously the rest goes to Strikeforce. But yeah, this was especially, man, what a racket that was with amateur fighters, you know, because they couldn't get paid anyways. So interesting stuff. But yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. But this brings us to the main card. Four fights to go over. At 205 pounds, Hodger Gracie defeated Trevor Prangley via submission, come by way of rear naked choke at 419 of the first round. Prangley was 23-6-1 with four KOs and nine submissions coming in. The South African Hammer had gotten the nod in six of his last eight bouts, losing to Tim Kennedy by submission in his most recent Strikeforce bout. However, he'd won a closely contested split decision fight with Keith Jardine the previous September and was looking to build on top of that.
Just before we get going here, I don't know if you noticed it, but he was introduced as Trevor Prangley, the accomplished and experienced. And I just thought, you know, I'd rather you just say Trevor Prangley if that was me than to force.
Or what happened to the South African Hammer? I mean, God, that's like heads and shoulders above the accomplished and experienced Trevor Prangley. Like, yeah, that's terrible. I did not notice that, though.
Yeah, it's Jimmy Lennon Jr.
Come on, Jimmy. Jeez.
He can make pretty much anything sound good, but I saw through that BS. That was
the accomplished and experienced. that's awful. Can you imagine Bruce Buffer today, you know, fighting out of the blue corner, the accomplished and experienced. Yeah, that's terrible. All right. Well, on the other side, Hodger Gracie was 3-0 with three submissions. A multi-time BJJ world champion, Gracie had beaten Ron Waterman, Yuki Kondo, and Kevin Randleman thus far in his career. That's quite a line of fighters to start off your career with. The last of those, the fight with Randleman, had come in Strikeforce. This would be a very stiff test for him, as obviously Prangley, as we just learned, was very accomplished and experienced. So this would be quite a test for Gracie, but he'd shown he had the skills to hang with some really quality, talented fighters, so we'd see what would happen here. Both Prangley and Gracie had fought Yuki Kondo. They had one opponent in common. Gracie had submitted him, and Prangley had knocked him out, so Kondo did not like fighting either of these guys. The 6'4 Gracie used his reach early on with some really nice jabs. A couple minutes in, the Brazilian shot in and secured the takedown. Prangley tried to fight the positioning, but Gracie's ground game, I mean, God, he's a Gracie, so as you would expect, was just too much. He advanced to full mount, and the South African tried to use the cage with his feet to get out of it and turning his back. And in doing so, it would prove to be his undoing. Gracie immediately saw the opportunity and latched onto the neck, securing a rear naked choke and eliciting the tap while he had the body triangle on. And Nice win for Hodger Gracie. He celebrated with Gracie family members such as Caesar and Half after the bout. I thought I saw Henzo in there, and it's possible he was there, but then I couldn't say that it was him for sure. And then I saw Half afterwards, which I had to look up Half. I recognized him. He fought in Pride at least once. And I was like, I'm pretty sure that's Half. And I actually had, it took me like 5 or 10 minutes to find out which Gracie it was. But a nice win for Hodger.
Yeah, Frank Shamrock noted that Gracie had sort of a boxer stance. He had his shoulder out.
Kind of lauded his stand-up skills, and I thought he did look good on his feet.
Yeah, so that was definitely notable. And I think Prangley, quite honestly, just fought a lazy fight. I don't think he really knew what to do, or he's had a game plan going in there. He was headhunting. He was throwing punches at the head, but he was throwing up. He couldn't really reach. And I just think when you got like a mass of flesh that Gracie is, you got to go for the body. You got to slug him in the stomach. You got to sort of do some Muay Thai. You got to knee him. You got to do something to sort of bring the level of his head down. So I just think Prangley was reaching, and he wasn't doing enough on the lower half of the body. And I mean, Gracie is just so, he's almost too big to be a good MMA fighter. Because he's so like kind of clunky in there, but this was one of the few fights where he put it all together and was able to beat a very accomplished and experienced South African fighter.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hey, you start off your career with wins over, Ron Waterman, former UFC and Pride heavyweight fighter, very talented guy. Yuki Kondo, very, very accomplished and experienced in his own right. And then, Kevin Randleman, former UFC heavyweight champion, who was, obviously past his prime at that point. But, I mean, that, and then you add Trevor Prangley, that's a really, really solid. I mean, you could retire right there and be like, man, successful MMA career. I believe he ended up leaving the sport at either 8-2 or 8-3. So, Gracie did end up, he did end up having a pretty respectable career. And, again, hats off to him. But you don't have to worry about Trevor Prangley not having good game plans anymore, because this would be it for him in Strikeforce. He continued to fight until 2015, left the sport with a respectable record of 35-11-1. We do have an interview with Prangley in the archives. It's a good chat with him. He's running, I believe, an AKA affiliate out in Idaho, if I remember correctly, and doing quite well. So, that's definitely worth checking out. And Gracie, he would be back in Strikeforce later on in the year to take on King Mo. All right, next bout at 265 pounds, heavyweight bout. Herschel Walker defeated Scott Carson, VTKO, coming by way of strikes at 3-13 of the first round. Walker, of course, was 1-0 with a TKO win over Greg Nudge almost exactly a year before this bout. It was 364 days before, which is interesting. But at 48 years old and a novice in MMA, he knew that his time was short, and so he had to make the most of it. And so he'd be taking on Carson, who was 4-1. All of his wins were coming by way of submission. His most decent fight ended in a loss. I'm sorry, not decent. His most recent fight at this point had ended in a loss to Lorenz Larkin.
In the promo before this, when they were doing the video packages, they talked to Herschel Walker, and he said, if I want to be an MMA fighter, I want to be a great MMA fighter. And I thought that was really telling, because it made sense in terms of how well he trained and how well he prepared. And I just wonder why he stopped. Now, I know he's 48, but if you have that mentality, most fighters go until they lose, right? Like, even Floyd Mayweather, he's retired, but he's still fighting. He's going to keep fighting until someone knocks him out, So I just think it's interesting that he had everything going for him, and he was so old, and he could lose, and nobody would care. They'd just be like, dang, he's Herschel Walker, and he lost at 48 or 49 or 50. So I just think I would love to know why he stopped after this fight.
Yeah, and to your point, at the in the post fight interview, he made no sound of why he stepped, or he made no hint that he was gonna walk away. He said he was gonna keep going, and that was it. But for whatever reason, he apparently, I don't know what happened, but he decided not to come back, and that ended up being it. But I did. Okay. Actually, no, I've got an interview right here. I was Googling it while we were chatting.
Yeah.
Herschel Walker explains why he stopped fighting. This was a 2017 interview. said, I couldn't get a fight. That's why he quit. He was 2-0, enjoying life, but he still wanted more. The reason I stopped fighting, I couldn't get a fight. I wanted to step up in talent. Most of the time, I'm doing this for fun because I love to do it, giving all my money to churches. Other guys are doing it for their career, so it's kind of hard to fight Herschel Walker when there's a very good chance you may lose, and he's doing it for fun, and they're doing it for career, so that's kind of tough. So he doesn't really miss it because he's in the gym all the time. Anyways, he says, I'm still at AKA all the time. This is 4 years ago, so I'm still training all the time. It just seems like he couldn't get a fight, and then, just couldn't get a fight, and so that was it. Yeah, so
I don't know. I don't know if I believe that. I feel like a lot of guys would want to fight Herschel Walker.
I don't know why. Who wouldn't want to fight Herschel Walker? Because, he's very inexperienced, but obviously a big name. I would think that you would want to. So.
And as we'll talk about, I mean, he did look beatable, at least, in part of this fight,
Yeah. So. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm just kind of reading a little bit more. And I'm sorry, listeners, that I'm kind of taking. I want it to be. Yeah. So he was, even back in 2016, he was still talking about fighting, said he'd be willing to fight Rampage Jackson. I want it to be a worthy opponent. I don't want it to be someone they handpicked, some bum that they found on the street that was fighting 15 years ago. I don't want it to be someone like that. I want it to be someone that will keep the integrity of this sport. So, it is what it is. And that was it for him, or this would be it for him. But let's talk about the fight itself. I got to say, I know you're not a big fan of Walker as a fighter, but he looked a little looser than his first fight, but he did still look pretty stiff. Carson unleashed a high kick early on, which grazed the football great, who screamed and then proceeded to drop his opponent with strikes. It was actually kind of cool. Carson recovered while Walker took top position. Walker would try to hurt Carson with strikes, while the more experienced Carson would look for submission opportunities. Eventually, Walker was standing with Carson on his back. When Carson went to get up, Walker hit him with a left hand, dropping him again, and the ref had seen enough and stopped the fight. I didn't really love the fight, didn't really love the stoppage. It seemed a little bit early, but Carson, who was being overwhelmed, just didn't, he didn't really protest it. So I think a good win for a guy that was 1-0 at the time.
Yeah, I didn't like the stoppage either. I felt it was a little bit quick. I guess he got caught in a way that the camera didn't catch. Hard to know. I didn't like the fight too much. I felt it was a sloppy fight. I think once Walker got hit, as you noted, he screamed. He's like, let's get it on. You lit me up. I'm awake now. Let's do this. And then he just kind of threw this like wild hand, and he hit Carson hard, and he dropped him, and it was sort of over. So I think, he definitely hit him, but I can't say that he, set him up with a jab and then landed and dropped him. It was just like, Carson got excited. He put his hands down and he got popped. And then the next thing you know, he's on the ground. What I will say about Herschel Walker is just you could see his intensity, his athleticism, his commitment, his durability. I mean, once he got Carson down, he just would not let him up. And that just shows that he's a high-level athlete. He knew he had the stamina. And he was not going to lose this fight after tasting a little bit of the punch and knowing what that feels like. Carson, having said that, had opportunities to submit him. He almost had a key lock, a leg lock. Walker slipped out, but as you said, Walker just tagged him and it was stopped. So give it to Herschel Walker for just being so resilient and not giving up and not letting Carson up. But 3 times he could have lost this fight.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Walker's so strong and athletic. I think he'd be pretty difficult for anybody to submit. And obviously, Carson being 4-0 with 4 submissions, he's a good submission fighter. Or, sorry, 4-1 with all of his wins come by way of submission. Obviously a good submission fighter. But, regardless, this would be it for both Walker and Carson in both Strikeforce and MMA overall. As we've said, you got to give a lot of respect to Walker for making his mark. And, at his age, going on and fighting in an elite promotion, going undefeated at 2-0, just one of the greatest American athletes in history. I don't think anybody can question that.
Yeah, and for what it was, this was great booking by Scott Coker. He put him in there with two people that Walker could beat, and Walker looked good. And it was a nice little something else for Herschel to add to his resume. Like, I'm also an undefeated MMA fighter. Dana White would have wrecked him, right? Dana White would have had him in there with Brock Lesnar in the second fight to pop a big pay-per-view rating, you know? Yeah. So I think this is a good story of MMA. I just wish we would have seen him against a guy like Lashley or just seen him fight a couple more times, because it's like, wow, the 48-year-old Herschel Walker, all-American athlete, MMA fighter. Keep going. Don't stop. Yeah, you know, yeah. That's all.
Yeah. I would have liked to have seen one or two more from him for sure, and against a name opponent, or maybe a guy that was kind of, like a CM Punk type guy, you know, another guy that's from another sport that's putting his toe in the water. While it kind of might have been a circus fight, I mean, that would have been a huge seller, and neither guy would have come out, you know, hurting from a brand perspective, basically. So, all right, co-main event time, 185 pounds. Jacare Souza defeated ruthless Robbie Lawler via submission, coming by way of rear naked choke at 2 minutes of the third round to retain the Strikeforce middleweight championship. Souza was 13-2 with 10 submissions. He had won the then-vacant Strikeforce middleweight title in a battle with Tim Kennedy on August 21st at Strikeforce Houston. So this would be his first defense. He'd brought his winning streak to 3 with that win. And the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and Judo black belt had previously defeated Joey Villasenor and Matt Lindland to earn his chance at the Strikeforce gold that he had then captured. And then, as mentioned previously, Lawler, 18-6 with 15 knockouts and 1 submission coming in, was coming off an absolutely brutal first-round knockout of Matt Lindland on December 4th at Strikeforce Henderson versus Bob Lou. He had alternated wins and losses in his last 5 fights. He had also defeated the likes of Melvin Manhoef and Scott Smith while losing to Renato Babalu Sobral and former Strikeforce middleweight champion Jake Shields. They did actually have 3 opponents in common. Both fighters had beaten Joey Villasenor and Matt Lindland, while Jacare had beaten Mayhem Miller, who had defeated Lawler. The champ got a takedown pretty early on, and it was just all over Lawler, smothering him like a blanket. However, the challenger was able to get back up and went after Jacare with strikes, nailing and dropping him. It was clear the Brazilian was hurt, and he was in trouble. I mean, his legs were shaky at best. The commentators pointed out that Lawler made a mistake by following Jacare to the mat, which allowed him to tie up and recover. Big John stood up the fighters, which seemed to benefit Lawler. He went after Jacare again, who survived until the bell, 10-9 Lawler, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think it was a close round, kind of half and half, I guess, because Lawler really hurt Jacare. I guess, you know, visually give it to him, but, you know, Jacare did really control it on the ground. Very close round. I do want to note here, I kind of want your opinion on this. Mauro mentioned that Jacare had been training with some great strikers, such as Junior Dos Santos and Anderson Silva. And as somebody who obviously grew up as a, you know, WWE fan, I did watch the Superstation, of course. I was able to find the Ric Flair channel. But as somebody who grew up watching WWE and they, like, never, ever acknowledged the competition, what do you think here? Strikeforce did this a lot. You know, they mentioned a lot of the UFC big-name fighters. And I think they sort of did it just to remind fans, like, hey, these are all MMA fighters here, and they all train together. They may just fight for different companies. But I also feel like it also really promotes the other brand in a way that they don't really need to be promoted. What do you think when you hear Strikeforce mentioning UFC names so frequently?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I disagree. I think it's a good thing because it legitimizes your guys and makes them sound like credible fighters because they train with these other guys that are obviously credible fighters. At the same time, I noticed something that Mauro said during this, he said that Javier Mendez, the AKA head coach, had said that if Herschel Walker had started in MMA as a young man, that he would have been a world champion. And he backed that up by saying he said that Cain Velasquez would be a world champion, and now he is. And he didn't say that Cain Velasquez was the UFC heavyweight champion. So they're not really mentioning UFC. They're not saying, yo, UFC middleweight champion Anderson Silva. They just said Anderson Silva. So it's different. I think if you're branding them, you know, if you're mentioning the promotion, that's one thing, and I could see that.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, the way I would agree with you is that when you're mentioning those names, if you're doing it to build your guys' credibility, you're already acknowledging that the UFC is what gives your guys' credibility, which isn't, yeah, you know, which isn't a good look for your brand. So I still think it's worth it. I still think it's a good thing. As long as you're not attaching the UFC name to those other guys, I think it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, good points all around. I think you're right. You know, it just always kind of feels weird. But you're right. They don't actually say UFC. They might say George St. Pierre or whatever. Yeah.
But let's move forward with the fight. When I say the second round was all Jacare, I mean it. I mean, he got a takedown early on. It was pretty much stayed there the entire round. He was improving position, going for submissions, almost got an armbar with about a minute left. But to Lawler's credit, he was able to escape, and he escaped another armbar attempt and got top position with under 30 seconds left, but wasn't able to do anything with it. Clearly a 10-9 round, maybe a 10-8 round for the champ, but probably more 10-9. But then it was more of the same in the third round with Lawler, as has often been the case in his career, being unable to compete consistently on the mat. Jacare got things down to the floor again and was able to secure both the body triangle, just like Hodge Gracie had in the opening bout, and the rear naked choke, just like Gracie, garnered a meek tap from Lawler. The champ had defended his title for the first time. Big win for Jacare.
I have to ask you, Phil, is there a worse fighter let me think of this, how to say this. Is there a fighter who's so good in the stand-up but absolutely horrid on the ground, more so than Robbie Lawler? I mean, Paul Daly comes to mind.
Yeah.
Like if you get Paul Daly down, you're going to win the fight probably. Robbie's gotten a lot better, obviously, you know, in his second UFC run. But, geez, I mean, once Robbie Lawler was down, he's like, there's no chance. You know, there's no way to win this fight. But, I don't know. Do you agree with me, or is that an overstatement?
I think his issue, because I think there are worse fighters on. I mean, obviously there are worse fighters on the ground, but as far as like the elite guys, there were guys that I'm totally like Semtex is a good example for sure. Daly's a good example. Scott Smith would be another example of a guy. If you got him down on his back, you know he was going to lose. Like it was just pretty much a given. Lawler got out of a few submission attempts here. Like he could get out. To me, his bigger issue was the mental side. And a perfect example of that is that him having Jacare rocked in the first round. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was clear Jacare was really rocked. I mean, he was on fish legs, and Lawler just inexplicably goes to the mat with a black belt in jiu-jitsu and judo. Like, dude, really? I mean, you just rocked this guy. All you got to do is stand back and say, get up. And Big John will stand him up. Dude, he would have been not even a moving target. He would have just been a target. Like, he was that badly hurt. It looked like it wasn't enough for McCarthy to stop the fight. But it looked like when you've watched as many fights as you and I have, you can tell when, like, a guy is on his way out or is in danger of being stopped. Jacare was definitely on his way there. Now, he recovered quickly, and who knows what would have happened, but Lawler absolutely had a chance to be the first guy to win Strikeforce and UFC gold, and he blew it because of the mental aspect of it. So I don't think it's so much that he was so awful on the ground, because he was strong and he could get out of stuff, and he did get out of stuff. But from a mental perspective, he would make really bad decisions. And that's why his record, I believe, is 28-15. Like, he's not, you know, like, yeah, he'll go down as you know, one of the better middleweights of all time. But, you know, he's not an elite all-time great, even despite his knockout power and his good cardio and stuff like that, because he, you know, his ground game never improved enough to be really all that great. But it's more, I believe it was more of a mental thing with him than it was, you know, him just being that bad on the ground.
He's also a terrible interview. So
he's also an awful interview. We've tried to, we have reached out to him and haven't heard back. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe I know he doesn't like doing interviews. So
he's the only one word answer interview I've ever done for, you know, 15 minutes of interviews. But hey, are there two Robbie Lawlers? Because I don't know. Did you notice his back tattoo? Like, does he still have that back tattoo?
I did notice. Actually, it's kind of funny you say it. I did notice his back tattoo. This was also the caveman Robbie Lawler, where he's got like the full beard and kind of like the messy hair.
Yeah.
So maybe, maybe. But I did notice it. I have no idea if he still has it. But yeah,
it's a significant tattoo to have removed, though. Like,
it would be. It would be, but for sure.
I swear I don't remember that tattoo and watching his UFC run, but I didn't take the time to, you know, Google Robbie Lawler's back tattoo.
Yeah, maybe we're good. I should. Yeah, maybe you should.
But anyway, I thought that it was a great win for Jacare. He was so good at this time with his jiu-jitsu. He was really tough to beat. And he sort of weathered the storm. And, you know, this is one of those things where jiu-jitsu beats stand up here, at least one of those fights. Yeah.
And Jacare was really training hard on his stand up, and he tried with Robbie, and just speaking of mental miscues, like that's a bad idea. But yeah, Jacare, not only was he great on the ground, he was very entertaining on the ground. You know, like he constantly improving, constantly moving, constantly going for submissions. He tried for a toe hold in this one, which was, which was pretty cool. And then when he didn't have the toe hold and he realized that, he had, I have to be careful how I say this, but essentially he was in a reverse cowboy position, we'll say, and when he was going for the toe hold, and then he swiped back and hit Lawler in the face with his fist behind him. So, Jacare was a pretty entertaining fighter for a guy that really, because some of those guys that were just ground specialists could be really boring, but not Jacare. But we would see him back. He would be back for another title defense later in 2011 against Josh's favorite all-time fighter, Luke Rockhold, who was cage side for this. By the way, I think I know who I think I know who Luke Rockhold's celebrity doppelganger would be. Let me lay this on you. Chris Isaac, the singer, the Foolish Game singer.
Yeah,
when I saw him cage side, that's who he reminded me of. So next time you're going down your Luke Rockhold Google rabbit hole, which I'm sure you do at least once a week, check out Chris Isaac and tell me if you think they look alike.
You know, don't even try to insult Luke Rockhold by putting some 80s washed up, slow ballad, dreary, depressing singer in the same category with him. But come on.
I humbly, humbly apologize.
If I Google Robbie Lawler's back tattoo and Chris Isaac, I'm definitely gonna have to delete my
history. Yeah, your wife's gonna be like, what is going on? Like, she sees your internet history and what is going on? Yeah.
I'll figure out a way. I'll respond to you on that.
But Lawler, for his part, he would be back later in the year as well. He would take on Jacare's previous victim, Tim Kennedy, in a fight. All right, we are at main event. It is 170 pounds. Nick Diaz defeated Cyborg Santos via submission, coming by way of armbar at 450 of the second round to retain the Strikeforce welterweight championship. This would be the second defense of his title for the mega popular Diaz, who was 23-7 with 12 knockouts and 7 submissions. Coming in, he had defeated Marius Zaromskis in January 2010 to win the vacant belt, and recently had defended it in a rematch with KJ Nunes from their Elite XC days. Those victories were part of Diaz's 8-fight win streak that had dated back to the mid-2008, back to mid-2008, and Stockton's favorite son was on a roll for sure. Cyborg, on his side, was 18-13 with 11 knockouts and 5 submissions. A powerful Brazilian striker, came into this one having won back-to-back bouts, which included a TKO victory over Zaromskis in a very memorable bout in Los Angeles. Almost always exciting, Cyborg also tended to lose a lot, as his record suggested. In fact, he'd only gone 5-5 in his last 10 bouts prior to the title shot. But this would obviously be the biggest opportunity of his career, and if he won, Cyborg would join his wife, Chris, as world champions in the same organization, which I believe would have been the first, and I think would be still the first chance that we would have to see a husband and wife couple both be world champions and in the same promotion. So that would have been pretty amazing.
Like Seth Rollins and Becky.
And Becky, yeah, that's right. Both being champions at the same time. So definitely on the same level. But before we begin this fight, before we get into the fight, I wanted to mention that Mauro talked about a 2006 fight between Cyborg and Melvin Manhoef that had happened for the Cage Rage promotion in England. And I did actually go and check it out on YouTube. And my God, it was violent. I mean, these two guys were swinging for the fences, and they ran out of gas. I mean, at one point, they're both like basically standing there staring at each other with their hands on their hips because they are both so gassed out. Cyborg, normally fought at, 170 pounds. That's what this fight was at. He was at 205 pounds for that fight with Manhoef, and so he was jacked and probably gassed to the gills. And they're both those guys just – they went at it as much as they could. In the second round, they just gassed out real bad. And in fact, at the end of the fight, Manhoef won by TKO, but he's flat on his back. Cyborg doesn't realize the fight's over, and he's leaning over Manhoef, and he's trying to hit him, and he's hitting him on the chest with basically the as much force as a six-month-old, like tapping on his doll. I mean, there was just nothing behind it, and it was so weak that the ref didn't realize that he was trying to continue to fight because the strikes were so weak. So he let him hit him like three times before he stopped him. And it's, but it is definitely a memorable bout. So yeah, just Google Evangelista Cyborg versus Melvin Manhoef. It's worth checking out for sure.
Yeah.
But let's get back to the fight. Really intense mid-cage stare down for the two competitors. They came forehead to forehead in front of the referee. Cyborg threw a high kick to open things up, which got a stream of trash talk started from Diaz. Huge chance of Diaz early on. Cyborg threw some really solid leg kicks early on, and Diaz was forced to respond and start defending those. And man, they were hurting him. I mean, he was moving differently as the round wore on. He was really having trouble. And Cyborg was just fighting masterfully. He just kept going back to those leg kicks, chopping down the champ, who was no longer talking trash. And he even actually kind of dropped him, and Diaz caught himself with one hand and was able to stand back up. But Cyborg was being patient, which he wasn't really known for. Very, very strategic. Things turned around for Diaz with just over a minute and a half left in the first when he clipped the challenger with a left hand. Clearly hurt, Cyborg started eating a stream of peppering Diaz punches. Some were stunning and hurting him even further. He was getting hit. You're getting hit, and then combined with all those leg kicks thrown, and Cyborg, as patient and as strategic as he was being here, everything, he reminds me so much of Wanderlei Silva. You know, he's got the head tattoo he's heavily tattooed. He's got the head tattoo in the back of his head. And, you know, just obviously kind of the axe killer look. He's Brazilian, you know, they're about the same skin tone. They're both shoot box fighters. So there's a lot of similarities. And another similarity between the two is that they don't throw jabs. I mean, like pretty much everything is thrown with full force. And Santos seemed to be gassing himself out when you combine that with getting hit and just throwing everything he's got. He seemed to be in trouble, but he survived. But what a round. I mean, tough to call it. I wouldn't fight anybody that said that they gave it to Diaz 10-9. I gave it to Cyborg 10-9, but it was a really close but extremely memorable round, and I really enjoyed it.
Phil, I think this was like another forgotten great round in Strikeforce history.
Yeah.
This was so intense, and I don't remember this.
I don't either. I did not remember this at all.
Yeah, this was a real treat, a real surprise to see such incredible action. This has to have been, at least for part of the round, one of Cyborg's most, you know, best technical displays against a high-level fighter. And what I really liked about this round was he brought out the best of Nick Diaz. Yeah. Too often Nick Diaz is like kind of joking in there. He's trash-talking. He's using a lot of nonverbal body language to taunt the other fighters. He keeps the fighters away at a distance. He paws at them. There was no room for that because Cyborg was really kicking his backside for part of this fight. And, those leg kicks were devastating. You could see Nick anticipating them and almost trying to lift his leg up beforehand so that he wouldn't be able to feel the full impact. Cyborg made Diaz fight, and he paid for it, but it's amazing. You make Diaz fight and we get a great fight instead of one of these fights where Diaz is laying on the mat, you know, trying to look cute just because he can. You know, right. This was a fight.
Yeah, it was great. But I realized in the second round, and the commentators ended up pointing this out, that I think Diaz was kind of suckering Cyborg in a bit, like knowing that he had the propensity to gas. I think he was just trying to weather the early storm because he, in the second round, it started off just the same. The Brazilian was throwing leg kicks. The Stockton native was talking trash. But Diaz just, he seemed more confident. And it was almost like he had a secret and that, you know, he knew Cyborg didn't know. Fewer standout moments for most of the second round, but with about 30 seconds left, Cyborg got a very nice trip takedown, was probably looking to ride the round out that way. But instead, Diaz caught him in an armbar from the bottom, secured the grip, flipped Cyborg over, positioned him, and got the submission. And it all happened. I mean, it was lightning quick, and it was 10 seconds left in the round. I was not expecting it at all. I mean, I knew that Diaz won by submission, but I didn't realize the exact timing, and so it caught me by surprise. But what a great, just what a great fight. Really good showing for Cyborg. I'm sure it was crushing to lose that way, but just a great fight. And like you said, Cyborg, whether Diaz was suckering him or not, I think Diaz, it really brought out the best in him. And, you know, there's a lot of respect between the two fighters after the bell.
Yeah, this, you know, you said it all. This was a really great fight. Cyborg brought the best out of Diaz. And how beautiful was that to see Nick Diaz just get that armbar on so quickly? Yeah. I mean,
so smooth.
Like, you thought the round was going to end, and all of a sudden it's over. And we talked about Robbie Lawler's mistakes mentally. What a huge mistake this was for Cyborg. Obviously, he's tired. He doesn't want to train punches anymore. But him taking Diaz down, so stupid. Like, it's just dumb. It's better to finish the round, back away, get on your bicycle, run, whatever you need to do. But he went to the ground and it was over. It's like a fly flying into a spider's web. It's just like, oh, he's dead. It's over.
Good point. But you deserve the credit for the, you know, the point that Diaz, it really brought the best out in him. And, you know, Santos was just, he was game, and Diaz gave him a lot of respect on the mic afterwards, but not before some very interesting stuff. Diaz went over to some part of the cage. I saw him say FUB to somebody, and he was flipping middle fingers.
Did he say B?
No. He said the real ones. sorry to use harsh letters, but he went over and was, you know, flipping the bird to somebody, and you know, there was like soda or beer thrown in the cage, and Cesar Gracie's trying to keep, you know, Nick from getting in trouble. And who could that be? And I guess there were rumors afterwards that it was him and Mayhem that were beefing. And then it was someone suggested that he was like basically flipping off Chris Cyborg and, you know, all this stuff. It ended up being, a group of unruly fans that like a bunch of anti-Diaz fans. Mm-hmm. I did find some articles afterwards where Scott Coker was interviewed and said that he pretty much, he knew who the group was, but he didn't know who the specific people were that were, you know, causing the issues. And so he said, if he did find out that they, you know, maybe we won't see them at a Strikeforce event again. I don't know whatever happened with it, but I was definitely glad that it wasn't, you know, Chris Cyborg. I mean, as, you know, forgive me for using the phrase, but as ruthless as Nick Diaz can be with, you know, kind of the mind games and stuff, I don't see him, you know, taunting the wife of, you know, the guy that he just beat, especially a guy that he'd shown a bunch of, you know, a bunch of respect to. But speaking of Chris Cyborg, I mean, she was in tears, and the camera, the Strikeforce camera or the Showtime camera guy was trying to, you know, get the camera in there to get a look. And Fabricio Verdun, who's a big dude, 6'4", 250, he was keeping his body and, you know, trying to get the camera away, which was, you know, a gentlemanly thing to do. They did have her on camera the moment that they showed in replay. They showed when Cyborg tapped, and she was just devastated emotionally. So that's who we were talking about earlier in the episode, obviously, that, you know, it was very emotional, and I felt bad for her. I legitimately felt bad for her. She was clearly crushed by her husband's loss.
Yeah, I'm sure Nick Diaz was not taunting her, but I mean, you know, Chris Cyborg's a fighter. I honestly felt worse for Miss Elizabeth when the Man lost the title to Ricky Steamboat at WrestleMania 3.
one of the most emotional moments in wrestling history would be WrestleMania 7, which is one of my all-time favorite WrestleManias, when Macho was a bad guy and he took on Ultimate Warrior, and Warrior in a really epic match beat him. And then Sherry was, you know, was berating him, and then Miss Elizabeth. And yeah, I don't, do you remember, do you know what I'm talking about? Do you remember that?
I was there.
So,
was
there. You were there? Yeah. Cause it was in LA. That's right. It was in LA.
I think I was a teenager, but yeah. I was there.
Oh dude, you were a teenager in 1991.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize you were that much older than me. I was 9 years old.
I was 13.
Okay.
13.
All right. Oh, okay. Just but no, so on commentary, which that was the, you know, the greatest, I mean, all apologies to Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler. Yes, I love them, but Gorilla and Bobby are my favorite. They may not be the best, but they were my favorite commentary team. Yeah. And they did this. I remember on, on the pay-per-view broadcast, they showed them on camera, and Bobby, the Brain Heenan's kind of just looking around. He says, "Hey, who's that?" In what was clearly like a very scripted moment. Yeah. And he's like, no, right over there. Is that Elizabeth? And, it's Miss Elizabeth. And like, she's sitting in the crowd. It clearly planned, camera shots. And then they kept, kind of referencing throughout the match and planting the seeds. And then she, gets up over the guardrail and runs down. And, they have that super, super emotional moment. There's legitimately people crying, never mind the crying guy from CM Punk's return to, wrestling at AEW. There was a guy with glasses on with a Macho Man hat that was just full on in tears. This like brunette redhead woman just burst out into tears. Like, it was so emotional. So yeah, I would, that's a legit call. I would feel worse for Elizabeth than I did for Chris Cyborg.
Yeah. They're actually a very sad story. Neither one of them's with us anymore.
Yeah. But, yeah. So legit, much, much sadder story, of course, but well, anyways, lots of respect again between Diaz and Cyborg after the fight. Diaz didn't call anybody out specifically, just said he'd be up for whoever. But a quick turnaround for the champ, as it would be him defending the strap against Paul Semtex Daly in another very memorable bout just a few months after this one. I believe it was about 3 months later. Cyborg would be back to tangle with Jordan Main later in the year, which obviously would be a pretty big step down from the champion. No disrespect to Jordan, but where he was at in his career at that point was an up-and-comer. So going from title shot to up-and-comer was obviously, again, pretty big step down. But let's wrap this up. No fighters popped for drugs of abuse or performance enhancers after the event. Total disclosed fighter payroll of $533,214.50. The salaries for the main card fighters, Nick Diaz took home $150,000, while Cyborg got $20,000, so pretty amazing delta between the two of them. Jacare earned $85,000, which included a $15,000 win bonus, while Robbie Lawler got $65,000. Herschel Walker and Scott Carson both got $5,000, which is kind of a crazy number there. Hodger Gracie earned $75,000, with Trevor Prangley taking home $30,000.
This feels like one of the higher payrolls in Strikeforce.
I'm not surprised that you're bringing that up with you seeing Diaz getting, $150,000 and Jacare getting $85,000. But you got to also remember there were fights earlier where, I think Shamrock Frank got like $400,000 for one fight, if I remember correctly. Yeah. Early on, him and Kung were getting $100,000, $150,000. So I actually feel like it was just kind of getting back to where they were at one point. But then, again, Scott Carson and Herschel Walker, main card guys, getting $5,000 each. Like, that's kind of crazy. So,
and Hodger Gracie getting $75,000, it's purely off his name. I mean, yeah. There's no reason he should get that much.
Yeah.
I mean, he should get that much, but everybody else should be getting a lot more. I mean,
yeah. I mean, it's sad that today, 75K is actually fairly decent. If you're getting 75 to win, to show and 75 to win, that's actually a fairly decent, contract in the UFC even today. So, I mean, it's definitely higher now, but we're talking, 10 years after this. It's become more like boxing than it should be, in that the tippy top guys are making tons of money. But if you're not a big name, there's still fighters out there that are, doing GoFundMe so they can, train full time. So,
well, I was listening to Matt Riddle interview with Ariel Helwani, who's a podcast, and he said he was getting paid 25 to win, or 25 and 25 to win. And he was talking about like how that was nothing compared to what he makes in the WWE.
Oh God, I'm sure he's just killing it in the WWE. If I'm a fighter and I got a chance at, going into MMA or going into WWE, I'm going into WWE. And a good example of this today, as we record this, Gable Stevenson, the heavyweight Olympic gold wrestler, his brother Bobby signed with the Performance Center, WWE Performance Center, earlier this week. And then right before we started recording this, there's a report out that Gable has signed with WWE, and he was being courted by both UFC and WWE. I mean, to me, that's a no-brainer. Why you know, why wouldn't you go to WWE over UFC? The money's better. You know, you're not, in theory, you're not getting punched for real. Yes, you're, you know, quote unquote competing more. You're on the road more and that sort of thing. But yeah, man. And you kind of, and I think I read a quote from saying like, you MMA will always be there. So, you know, why not do the Brock thing? Maybe he does wrestling for a while and then goes into UFC for a while and comes back an even bigger, you know, bigger name. So
yeah, he doesn't have to worry about getting hit super hard for real unless he wrestles Nia Jax.
Yeah, so. God. And then he definitely will. So, you know, not as exciting as Henderson versus Babalu 2, but truly a vintage performance from Nick Diaz against a very game Cyborg in the main event. I greatly enjoyed that fight. The other fights paled in comparison. Though it was a big deal for Jacques Ray to get a win over Robbie Lawler, and Hodger Gracie looked good. But what did you think overall, Josh?
Well, it was pretty much a one-match show. The main event was outstanding. It was nice to see Herschel Walker compete, and Robbie Lawler and Jacques Ray was decent. But that main event, you know, it was worth it. It made it a good show for me. But let's be honest, how bad of a show can it be? We got 3 seconds of Luke Rockhold at cage side.
Oh, my God.
I mean... They're just promote.
You know, I can't imagine what this. You know, we haven't even covered an event with Luke like competing on it yet. Like, that's coming pretty soon. I can't even imagine what that's going to be like with you. God.
Well, because you know Luke Rockhold fights about as often as Haley's Comet comes. And by the way, Luke Rockhold is fighting soon, isn't he?
I believe that he is lined up to fight pretty soon here. So
we should do a live stream of that. No, I'm kidding.
Dude, I may, like, whatever the first Luke Rockhold, you know, show that we come to on here, I may just record it without telling you, and then you'll never speak to me again. But no, I'm sure it'll be good once we get there. But yeah, so I'm looking forward to covering our next event. We've got some cool ones lined up. I do have. By the way, did you ever interview Luke?
Yeah, I interviewed Luke a few times. I probably shouldn't say it. I interviewed him, and he's classic Santa Cruz, California surfer. Okay. No doubt. You know, he's just like kind of like KJ Nunes. He's just a casual dude, you know. What was it? I did something on him where he was not very happy with the interview. It was some feud. It might have been the Bisping thing. Remember they trained and Bisping was like, I'm the Strikeforce champion. I don't think he liked that interview that I did with him, but for the most part it was pretty decent.
Well, they're interactions. Cool. They're cool now. They trained recently. They trained together recently and they're actually good now. I actually have his email and his cell phone from back in the day. So once we kind of get to you know, one of those cards, I'm definitely gonna try to reach out and see if we can get him on the show. So, and
I'll turn on him on the show.
There you go.
We'll hotshot an angle.
There you go.
Our podcast will go through the roof.
There you go. All right. Well, the next event we're going to cover does not feature Luke Strikeforce, or Luke Skywalker, or Luke Rockhold. It does feature Strikeforce Fedor versus Silva. It marked the beginning of the Strikeforce Heavyweight Grand Prix, which Scott Coker gave me a sneak peek at before he announced it. I remember we were at a Noah's Bagels in San Jose, and he said, "Have you signed your NDA?" And I think I said yes without thinking, and I had never actually gotten an NDA, but I didn't tell anybody. So I kept it to myself. But as you would expect, there were some big boys in this card. Valentine Overeem taking on Ray Safo, who's now one of the leads for the PFL. Chad Griggs battled Jean Villante. Shane Del Rosario locked horns with LeVar Johnson. Sergey Haritanov met fellow Eastern European slugger Andrei Arlovsky. And then in the main event, as you might have guessed it, Bigfoot Silva got his chance at the heavyweight GOAT, Fedor Emelianenko. I won't reveal the winners, but all 5 main card bouts ended in a stoppage, so I think this is going to be a fun one to discuss. But
this is when I officially started to hate Bigfoot Silva.
There you go. So. Yeah, and that might be a bit of a spoiler. But anyways, listeners, again, you can find us on social media. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at The Hexagon Pod, and you can reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. Would love to get your feedback. But we've got some cool things in the pipeline, possibly – you know, who knows what we'll have, which fighter we'll have on next, but stay tuned to find out. With that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. Hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy. We will see you soon.
Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. They are able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcast.